Hello, everyone. My name is Phil Blancato, and I'm CEO and president of Latimer Thalmann Asset Management. Here we go, spiraling through yet another week. Wednesday, October the 21st. Well, as always, let's start the week off on what's the latest and greatest with the markets. As we can tell from the markets, they tend to be very resilient. We're watching them lately in spite of the fact that, to be quite honest with you, the data around the U.S. economy and more importantly, what's going on with the virus, have been just okay for this past week. Really a very much a mixed bag. So specifically, when I look at the stock market now, up just about 10% on the year, hanging on to these levels, and you look at the bond market, up just about 7% on the year, it really does make you pause for a minute and ask yourself, how could it be that in spite of the fact that the earnings projections for the S&P 500 for the third quarter would be still be a negative 22%. Improvement from negative 32%, but still quite negative. Our GDP growth should at this point, estimates are positive 31% for the second quarter, but still not nearly enough, for the third quarter, not nearly enough to counteract what happened in the second quarter. We are at nearly all-time highs in the stock market. Is the stock market disconnected from the economy? Is the stock market disconnected from the virus? As we continue to plot our way through this, one of the things about this past week is watching the stock market hold on here. One of the most recent narratives is the potential for a Biden victory as well as a Democratic sweep of the House and the Senate. And interesting, I thought I would start there this week, that the House and the Senate are a critical component to the next component of what's going to happen with our overall U.S. economy. And the reason why I start there is, let's just be honest, we're on the cusp of a fairly significant election. And I know so many of us have concerns, maybe personally, maybe about where you vote. As I think you know, we try and avoid politics. We need to just have success based on what goes on with politics and not get too caught up on one side or the other. Be apolitical. But one thing that's interesting, if you get a Democratic sweep of all three, and if they get the majority in the Senate like they do in the House, that does create an interesting scenario. That in that scenario, the expectations would be a $2.5 trillion stimulus package. Add to that that you would potentially eliminate the filibuster, which would remove some of the impasses, which would be a boost for minimum wages. You would have antitrust rules and regulatory policies, but certainly a large infrastructure bill to follow it. And then reparations along the way that would come from what they would do for folks who have been underserved or the wage gap. So a significant win by the Democrats, just talking economics for a minute, really says that the size of the majority matters. So it's one thing to win by 50 vote win in the Senate. It's a whole other ballgame if they get to the majority. And if the majority, how far will the Democrats take that and how stimulant would it be for the overall U.S. economy? Something to ponder as we head towards the polls, that a $2.5 trillion stimulus package would be just about 12% of GDP. That's just about what we've lost in this pandemic so far, at least. We're recovering a bit. But certainly there's something to be said for those of us who might be worried about it. What would happen to a Democratic president, House and Senate? It could have a positive impact for markets and a positive impact for growth of assets. In fact, the last time we had a Democratic House and Senate, the reality was we ended up with a, believe it or not, 10% average rate of return in that time period. So something to think about. Starting with a little bit on economics and a little bit about politics this week, simply because we all know that this is one heck of a hot topic. No doubt about it when we think about where we are in the world and how much we have to continue to focus on this, if nothing else. All right, let's keep going through here for a little bit. I think one of the questions that comes up often, I get this all the time, is are we heading towards a recession? Are we getting a second dip in the recession? And squarely, while recent data, for example, when I looked at the recent jobless claims, they've ticked a bit higher. I mean, we've seen jobless claims where we had 22 million people out of work, now it's down to 11. But weekly jobless claims have been stuck around 850,000 per week. In fact, a marginally higher. That's somewhat disappointing because we had hoped that weekly jobless claims would go back down to that 100,000 to 200,000 natural rate level. And simply put, it just has not happened. So the economy is still not strong enough to pull the remaining people in, and probably won't be for a while. We saw things like industrial production or how much we manufacture weaken a bit, still be stronger than they were back in March, but weaken a bit. And these fears of a double dip recession started to take hold. We did see an excellent retail sales number that the public came in and spent some money, or a significant improvement over the summer. So we are seeing people who are gainfully employed spending some money again, and that's an exciting thing. But I get the question a lot around a recession. And the reality is, as we continue to have good signs around the labor market, albeit not as good as we wanted, it really comes down to the infection rate. Will the infection rate lead to another lockdown? I don't think we get a recession unless we have to have a significant lockdown or we don't get a significant stimulus package. So the other side of the election, if President Trump wins and we get a Senate and Congress run by the Democrats, inevitably both sides agree that we'll need some stimulus package. And I do think it may not be as large, probably more like $2 trillion rather than $2.5 trillion. And we probably won't get some of the other bills that the president would oppose, but I do think you'd still get an infrastructure package. So see, either way, that's positive. That's not recessive. That's a positive way to look at it. So really the only fear I have is that would we get a significant lockdown again because of an increase in the virus cases and, more importantly, increase in fatalities. But at this stage of the game, with where we are with vaccines and medicines and stimulus, that seems highly unlikely. I think we have stimulated our way well into being out of the recession and growing significantly. We're seeing the data be less bad. Earnings for the second quarter, as I mentioned, negative 22, but they were negative 32 earnings for the third quarter, forgive me, the year's flying by, are projected to be negative 22 when they were negative 32 for the second quarter. So certainly an improvement there and no doubt. One thing we did notice is the IMF, the global standard for gauging everything related to how the globe was going to grow, expected this year the globe to contract at 5.2%. They've now improved that to negative 4. So it's quite a bit of improvement considering you're thinking the whole globe. And China is actually coming in with a positive 5% GDP growth rate for the third quarter. So certainly some positive signs are out there that it's a mixed bag. Not as bad as it was, not as good as we'd like it to be. So economics, and leading with economics this week, tell me that in that mixed bag, is there something we can focus on that's really going to make tell us where we're going from here? And I mentioned earlier retail sales, and I just want to come back to that for 1 second. In September, retail sales increased by 1.9%. Clothing and accessories led advances by 11%. Sporting goods by 5.7%. We had a drop in electronics of 1.6%. And why this is all very relevant to me, in fact, September 2020 also represented a decline from a year ago of 6.4%, is in this microcosm of data, we see growth over the summer, but not yet back where we were. And that so much tells us about where the stock market is at. From the idea being, in order to be successful from here, we need earnings growth. In order to have earnings growth, we're going to have further economic expansion. In order to have further economic expansion, we certainly are going to need a way to get out of this pandemic and get more people back to work. A couple of good data points. Consumer sentiment came out, rose to 81.2 in October, up from 80.4. Not near the 100 it was pre-pandemic, but a significant improvement from the 70s that it was when this all began. Housing continues to be a bright spot, where September's housing starts rose 1.9%. Month over month, people are building and buying new homes. It's a great sign as far as the overall market impact goes. So happy to see that there is a mixed bag around economics, not perfect, but not terrible. When you surmise it all together, a positive bond market, a positive equity market, remember both of them are looking out at future expectations, more along the lines of what is to come rather than what has happened. And for that reason, we continue to be optimistic that if we can get out of this current environment we're in with a vaccine or an antivirus and be able to continue to open up, the likelihood of a very robust first quarter, regardless of who's president, should be really pretty interesting to see. But one thing to remember as well, one of the data points we watch closely is the spending that's going to take place here for Halloween, Thanksgiving, and the holiday season thereafter. This is the most prolific spending time of the year, whether it's Amazon Dual Prime Day or the numerous other companies that are competing with Amazon like Walmart to offer inexpensive options for you to spend more. And the reality is, if a stimulus package comes, we'll couple that with the spending season. Hold on to your hats. The data could get a lot better much faster. And that is why the stock market is up nearly 9 to 10% this year. Let's not forget, the Federal Reserve has committed to keeping interest rates lower for longer, more than likely not even considering them for the better part of 2 years, if not longer than that, 3 or even 4 years. The Federal Reserve has been very accommodative this whole way through. The federal government, if we can get to some agreement, just today the market rallied from a negative day to a positive day with Speaker Pelosi coming out and suggesting that we're making some progress. Seems like that's a narrative we hear every single week. Make progress and then it just doesn't happen. But certainly the data tells us that the market is waiting for the stimulus package, waiting to get past the election, and then reestablish itself from there to see if it's going to grind higher through the end of the year with positive spending, or is it going to hold off a bit. Let's switch gears and talk about the virus. So I think it's very important that we not lose sight of what's going on in the world. We're now at 31 million people recovered from the virus. That's an incredible number. Roughly 41.5 million have been infected, and tragically, 1.15 million have passed away. When we look at the United States, it's kind of a tale of two stories. Actually three stories now. We had the early spike going into this when it first all began. And remember, we had significant number of cases back in June with 70,000 cases a day. Then we tailed off and got down into the 40s, nowhere near as low as we were in late June, around 25,000. That seems like a long time ago. We had that spike, if you remember, back in September, where we had some pretty rough days, and we saw case counts get higher once again, in some cases as high as in the 70,000. But now we're going through a minor spike again. So a little spike in the beginning, up to 30,000 cases a day, and then back down to 23. That summer spike of up to 70,000 cases down, then back down to, you know, our low point, 28, and now back spiking again. But interesting point, when you look at the number of active cases that we have, meaning how many people are getting sick versus how many people are getting better, it is basically flatlined now since just about the end of August. Recently, there's a very modest uptick, but by and large, we're not seeing a significant number of active cases. Now, active case doesn't mean you're in a hospital. This means you're actively sick with the virus. And we look at our fatality rate. The worst we ever were was roughly 2,700 cases a day, falling all the way down to around 600 cases a day, spiking back up to about 1,000 cases a day, and then consistently for quite a while being right around 700. So even in the throes of this second wave, we are not seeing hospitalizations be overrun yet. Now, it is early. And certainly when we look at it, our average case count is up, new cases over the last few weeks. But we're also testing between 3.5 to 4 million people a day. And that does matter. The number of cases that we're testing is going higher. But case in point, let's look at Spain for a minute. I think Spain is a great storyline to track. Spain has had it pretty rough. They had it pretty rough in the beginning of this thing, and now they're having it pretty rough again. So let's look at their active case count. Spain's active case count has gone from flatlining to turning back up again. Okay, not significantly higher. In the beginning of this, their case count was around 10 to 11,000 a day at its worst. They got all the way down to around 500 cases a day and had really beaten the virus down. So no new cases basically over the summer at all. Then by late July, they began to spike again. And today, they have more new cases now than at any time during the virus. In fact, their average now is anywhere from 11 to 14,000 per day. It's done a little bit better lately, around 12,000 a day. But certainly, they have had more new ACT cases today, higher, and for longer than at the initial spike. But a very odd scenario. The first time around, they had average deaths anywhere from 800 to as much as 1,000 people passing away a day, and then eventually tailed off and got down to almost zero on many days during the summer. And now they have gone through a bit of a spike, but only a fractional number, between 100 to 200 people passing away a day. And when you look at their current fatality rate, for every million people, roughly 2.5 people are dying of COVID, that's still nowhere near where they were when it was triple that early on in the pandemic. As I mentioned already, the United States has flatlined in spite of new cases. Places like France, who have also had a pretty tough go, have also increased their new case rates significantly higher than everyone else, significantly higher than even when they began this thing. But for some reason, we're not really focusing on, I think, what matters most, is that while the total number of cases today, for example, France in the beginning had around 5,000 cases a day, and now they have 15,000 cases a day, and in some days they had a day of 32,000 cases just the other day, triple, quadruple, quintuple where they were when this thing began. But the and this, by the way, has been going on now since the beginning of September, that they've significantly exceeded how much they had it initially. When you look at the fatality rate, it's nowhere near where they were. Whereas in the beginning, they had anywhere from 500 to 1,500 people passing away per day. Now the numbers are just about 100 people passing away per day. So you have to ask yourself, what matters more, new cases or fatality? In our opinion, from an economic standpoint, fatalities matter more, because it's highly unlikely that we'll lock down again if the fatalities and the hospitalizations don't increase. And as of right now, when we look at hospitalizations around the world, they're up modestly, but nowhere near as significant as they were the first time through. And that's simply because of the age. The average age of the person being infected in Europe today is between 35 and 40, whereas the average age the first time was over 75. Therein lies clearly the difference as to who's getting it, regardless of the number of new cases and what's happening. Put a different way, you know, when you look at the number of hospitalized people per million, again, using, I'll tell you what, I'll use France again. For every million people back in March and April, 500 were hospitalized for COVID, whereas today it's about 100. So think of it this way, quadruple, quintuple the number of new cases, one-fifth of those that were in the hospital originally. So it's fractional compared to where we were not but long again. And when you look at places like the ICU, again, I'll use France as an example. France, per million people, had 120 people in the ICU. Now they've got 20. And their case count, again, is significantly higher. The same narrative for the United States, the same narrative for Spain, the same narrative for just about every other country who's going through a second wave. So while the second wave looks scary and sounds terrible, as of now, it is not putting pressure on the hospital system and is not having an unintended consequence as to, as of right now, as to where we go from here. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, someone who I really respect and I think has really been an outsider, a former FDA official, looking on the inside and trying to keep it honest. And his point was that right now we are a week away from seeing a rapid acceleration in cases. And he believes the coronavirus and hospital rates will surge as well, because there is no therapeutic or vaccine as of now. And as of now, this is will become a much more serious problem. As much as I respect Dr. Gottlieb, if Europe is our leading indicator, that as of now is simply not the case. We will monitor this over the next few weeks, keep a very close eye on it, but as of now, it is not resulting in exactly what's been forecasted as far as hospitalizations. And that matters because not playing politics, but squarely on the idea that as of now, we don't need to shut back down as we continue to reopen. Another case in point, that overall coronavirus fatality rate fell again, now down to 2.75. In fact, that's the lowest at any time since the virus began. And whether that's remdesivir that's helping out, therapeutics that are being used, like, believe it or not, zinc, Pepcid AC, different types of procedures in the hospital, less ventilation, more oxygen. When you look at it on a global scale, the reality is the number of cases continue to go higher, 300,000 to 400,000 per day, yet the fatality rate is actually flat or lower. Even places like India, which were really looked upon as a very difficult situation, their total case count skyrocketed, but yet their fatality rate has also come down recently, right along with the number of new cases, where India's fatality rate is actually quite low now, just down to about ours, and their new case count has bent and gone the other way. Actually, at their peak, there were roughly around 90,000 to 100,000 cases a day, and today down to half of that at 47. So there is success being had in the management of this, and it's being resulted in less people passing away, thank goodness. But let's see how the next few weeks play out. As far as the second wave in the United States, just a few things to think about here. And when you look at the reality is our fatality rate over the last 7 days is only up about 20 people, so really very consistent, but yet our new case count is back above 50,000. However, the states that are most concerning, North Dakota, there are 209 people hospitalized due to COVID in North Dakota, 170 in regular hospital and 39 in the ICU with 16% of beds available. Forgive me that those, while the state is spiking, certainly, they do not sound like significant number of people getting it compared to other states we have seen. South Dakota, 304 people in the hospital, 244 in the ICU, 60 in the ICU, in the non-ICU, excuse me, 244 in the non-ICU and 60 in the ICU, with roughly 38% of beds available. There's been a lot of talk about South Dakota, and yes, they're going through a spike, but they went from just a few people getting it to a few hundred, so it looks terrible on a chart, but in pure numbers, it's not as significant. Montana, another state being mentioned, has a death rate of 1%, less than any other state in the country. So very impressive numbers there. And Wisconsin, probably the one that's most talked about. Remember when we talked about Florida, Texas, Arizona? Those seem to be foregone. California is foregone. We don't talk about them anymore because they're really not an issue. The latest is Wisconsin. So Wisconsin, as of right now, to be specific, has a 7-day positivity rate of 12%. That's high. That's more than double the national average. Has 1,172 people hospitalized due to COVID, 959 last week. So it's a tick up in the hospitals. 870 non-ICU, 716 last week. 302 in the ICU, 243 last week. They're going through a spike. But retrospectively, still not nearly as significant as some of the statistics we call coming out of the big states like Florida, Texas, Arizona, New York, New Jersey. So I don't know. It is a concern. But interestingly enough, not, I don't think, so concerning as of yet that you would shutter down the economy. And by the way, available hospital beds are up to 18%. So there are more COVID people, but the other folks aren't going to the hospital. When you look at some of the statistics, I think it does help to be objective and try and be careful. Unfortunately, politics are not allowing us to be very objective. In a recent poll by Gallup, 64% of Republican men and 54% of Republican women are saying that they are ready to return to normal activities right now. Yet only 5% of Democratic men and 3% of Democratic women felt the same way. Politics certainly have had played into this as well. One other kind of interesting point, when you compare COVID pandemic to the Spanish flu, For every million people at that time period, 4,000 got the Spanish flu back in 1918. When they had a second wave, for every million people, 2,000 got the Spanish flu. That's a pretty significant pandemic. In 1929, there was another pandemic similar where 1,500 per million got the Spanish flu. And today, when we look at COVID in comparison, it's roughly about, depending on the day, 700 to 800 per 1 million. So nowhere near as significant as what the Spanish flu was. And in fact, the 2018 swine flu was also only about 500. So COVID is close to 1,000, where the 2018 swine flu was just about, the flu season was about 500. So my point is, as of now, COVID is having an impact, but compared to other serious pandemics, not as serious, at least as of yet. A sad point, San Francisco is on pace to suffer from more than 675 overdoses and deaths in 2020, a 53% increase from 2019 for a total of 441. That would represent 234 additional overdoses deaths this year, nearly double the 123 COVID deaths that were in the city this year. So there are other things impacting us besides COVID, but it seems like that is all we focus on these days. Some other data points that are relevant to where we go from the economy and from here. I think it is interesting that there are other countries that are spiraling fast ahead of us. As of right now, there are 6 vaccines approved. Russia has now approved their second vaccine and will have a third one by December. The first one, Sputnik V, has over 40,000 participants in it, 16,000 people having already received the 2-shot vaccine. and they're carrying out adaptive phase two and phase three human trials with 1,500 patients. By the way, an adaptive trial means they actually give somebody the virus after they've had the vaccine to prove that it works. So live testing on live people. That's pretty aggressive. In fact, there's another country I'll mention in just a minute doing the exact same thing. When you look at where Russia is at and where China is at, they are not only actively using their vaccine in their own countries, Russia is being very aggressive in places like the UAE, which is vaccinating 2,000 people on the front line, Bahrain, which is working with China to vaccinate their frontline people, running their own studies, and are actively using their vaccine in other places around the world. In fact, when you look at somewhere like a Brazil, who has taken a really interesting track, Brazil has decided that they are going to go out and work directly with China, and that they found in their studies that unfortunately their the vaccine coming out of China has a higher success rate as of now than the vaccines coming out of the United States. And for that reason, Brazil seems to be, while working with Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer, is very along the path with rolling out an effective treatment that will be specific to the Chinese Sinovac vaccine. And they think it's the one that they'll use for their population in short order as well. So other countries around the world are being a bit more aggressive. Now, interesting, India pushed back a bit with Russia to say that they weren't thrilled with the idea of the first study for their vaccine being so small, so conducting their own study. But as I mentioned earlier, whether it's already Sinovac or the Russian vaccines, both of them are in one facet or another being used. And heck, even Brazil is using a 9,000-person volunteer study to try and conduct their own effectiveness on it. So rolling out their vaccine as quickly as possible. Interesting that England's Deputy Chief Medical Officer, Professor Jonathan Van Tam, this week told members of Parliament that the vaccine being developed by Oxford University, which is currently on hold in the United States with Oxford's AstraZeneca, could be available for a high-priority group this year, before the year's over. And even more interesting is that they're considering a study where they will actually give the virus to folks and let them prove that the vaccine works. So another country considering doing the exact same thing. Moderna, an American company, has come out and said that by November, they will have their results, early November, and that they're on track to have 20 million doses of its experimental drug ready by the end of the year. And they've already enrolled 26,000 participants in their 30,000-person study. That one sounds very promising for us. They've also partnered with other firms to create more doses of their vaccine to hopefully inoculate the rest of the country. Pfizer has 100 million doses will be available this year, with 1.3 billion by the end of 2021. They've already applied for emergency use of their COVID vaccine in the United States, looking for approval, and are manufacturing hundreds of thousands of vials as we speak. They seem to be the most aggressive in producing it and being ready to roll this year. So that's interesting. Johnson & Johnson, disappointingly, still on hold. We'd hope we'd get some positive news from J&J this week. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case. Other disappointing news, we have not gotten an update from Regeneron or Eli Lilly as to their approval by the FDA to be able to use an emergency use situation like they did with the president. So much surprisingly, those vaccines are not being made available as of yet, those antivirals not being made available as yet, as we had hoped they might, because they certainly would be a solution to getting us out of this thing. One interesting point that I picked up, I thought was very, very interesting, was that when you look at the South and what's happened in the South, the recent unemployment data came out. The South seems to be a little bit less concerned about COVID. However, that's reflected in economic data. Believe it or not, the unemployment rate in the South was actually lower than every other region in the country. In fact, the number of people employed was 6% lower in the month of August than it was in February, but then comparison to the Northeast at 10.6% lower, and the West at 8.2, and the Midwest at 7, the South seems to have been able to open their economy stronger and more effectively than everywhere else. However, they did pay for it to a degree in deaths. So they had 60 deaths per 100,000 people, which is higher than the Midwest at 52 and the West at 40, but much lower than the Northeast, which has the highest unemployment rate at 132. So the South, less restrictive in lockdowns, a bit more deaths because of it, but are experiencing a much faster recovery from an economic standpoint and are much more open than really every other region in the country. And finally, I'll just wrap up with the latest and greatest debate on the herd immunity. That there was a report that came out that was really quite interesting last week. And if you remember, I mentioned about there were a group of doctors called from Barrington that believe we could introduce a herd immunity by protecting the elderly and those with the pre-existing conditions and letting the younger folks getting back to work. It was called the Great Barrington Declaration. Dr. Fauci actually was finally asked what he thought about it, and he actually thought that it was, quote unquote, ridiculous and flawed. And the reason why, never in history, and this is a quote, never in history of public health and herd immunity have we had a strategy responding to an outbreak using herd immunity. In fact, he felt like it would lead to thousands of deaths and millions more people being infected than necessary. Further on, epidemiologists estimated that it would require between 50 to 70% of the population to reach herd immunity, which would create so many deaths, it's just not a viable solution. Not a doctor or a scientist, but on one hand, we've got these folks telling us that places like Sweden, where it has worked to a degree, they've got a high death rate in Sweden, but they are out of the virus completely, versus a Dr. Fauci and other scientists saying that's just too risky for us to do. Hard to call in the midst of all this, trying to figure out what is the right way to look at this and what are the anecdotal consequences of which process we go down. As of right now, the S&P 500, as I mentioned, up about just shy of 9% on the year. On an equally weighted basis, we're still down 1.5%. Remember, the top five stocks are up over 40% on the year, and the rest are all pretty much down. So it's a narrow market. And when markets are narrow, the key thing is make sure you're in high-quality equities. Don't overbet on the equity market with still so many unknowns. Prepare for some volatility to come in the form of the election cycle, as you see this week and the end of last week. News like things along the way related to whether or not we're going to get a large stimulus plan or not, what's the number of new cases that are going to create volatility. But if you're in high-quality large-cap stocks, high-quality fixed income, you're participating in the market, looking for an opportunity to increase your risk assets as we get through the election and begin to spend more from a federal standpoint, we believe the market will grind higher through the rest of the year. More importantly, stay safe. Hopefully you're wearing masks when you're indoors in an environment where you need to protect yourself. Hopefully one of the antivirals will be made available to us all sooner rather than later, and maybe a vaccine thereafter. Take care, everybody. Look forward to talking to you next week.